On today's College Football Inquirer, we made it. It's week zero. There is football on our TVs this weekend, or in front of you if you happen to be in Dublin, Ireland, because that is where Farmageddon is being played. Kansas State and Iowa State opening the 2025 college football season. We'll break down the game and also the future of week zero. Plus, we'll talk about Rich Rodriguez back in Morgantown. Is West Virginia chasing nostalgia, or do they bring back a coach who's ready to have them winning again? Also, our boldest predictions for the 2025 season today on the College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer. I am Andy Staples here with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. And before we get started with the football that you're actually going to get to watch this weekend, I want to tell you about how you can watch us. Because this week, the Yahoo Sports Network launched, Yahoo's first ever streaming TV channel, and you can watch the College Football Inquirer on the Yahoo Sports Network. It's available to stream on leading FAST services that would be free ad-supported television services. So you can find it on your TV, on your home screen. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv. You can catch all the shows on your phone or on your browser, so you can look at our beautiful faces, or, well, Ross and Godfrey's beautiful faces. Gentlemen, how are we doing? Ross, you're in Chapel Hill?
I'm in Chapel Hill. I went on a little camp visit the last few weeks, and this stop was Chapel Hill to see the Belichicks. So did that, and hopefully we'll have a story next week on all my time spent here. But it's nice. It's interesting. Lots of change here. Lots of change at the administrative level and the coach level.
So Ross, you've done the pendulum, because we're going to talk about Rich Rodriguez and West Virginia later in the show. And now you've just had some interaction with the Belichicks. So that is the emotional spectrum of college football coaches.
Opposites, yeah. A little bit, huh?
Just a lot of, I've interviewed Rich Rod many times in my career, and I know Andy has as well. No space for an awkward silence, right? Rapid fire, staccato, if you will.
No, Rich Rod, right. Like, you can tell when he's workshopping his jokes that he's going to say in various other interviews to you. And do we think Bill Belichick has ever workshopped a joke that he's going to drop in a press conference? I don't think so.
I tell you what, though, I was at his presser before I sort of kind of got time with him alone, but I was out his presser, and he did drop, like, somebody asked him about, you know, the starting quarterback competition. Okay. And he was like, oh yeah, we'll get that right to you as soon as possible, because what we want to do is get our whole starting lineup out there for the opponent as soon as possible. So we'll get right on that. So, okay. You know, he had a little tongue in cheek, everybody had a giggle.
TCU knows it's Gio Lopez.
Yeah.
I don't know how to break this to you, bud.
I like that. At least he's embracing something vocal instead of just doing the stoic sort of countdown, like count back from 10 and just wait for the awkward silence to overtake the room. I mean, at least he's being like, you know, 90s level smarmy stand-up comedian. Yeah. I'll take that, Belichick. That's fine.
Mike Leach made a whole career of not answering questions about his football team directly.
Yeah, he did.
That was the whole shtick. So, guys,
think about, I would say every favorite quote you have of Mike Leach came at the expense of someone who's actually covering Washington State or Texas Tech, standing there being like, please God, just answer what I asked about the quarterback.
Favorite Halloween candy was to avoid.
Yes.
You know, mascot death match was to avoid talking about the offensive line or defensive line. So
he went 8 minutes on how to prevent bugs from biting you in Valdosta, Georgia. And I asked the question, and the guy next to me covering the Cougars wanted to stab me, because then he was off the podium and he was done.
Also, valuable advice if you've ever been in Valdosta. If you've ever been to Wintersville, you know keeping the bugs away is important.
Nat line,
I say this as someone who lives 80 miles south.
Yeah, you're below the Nat line.
Gentlemen, there's football on our televisions this weekend. Farmageddon! Kansas State and Iowa State playing a classic rivalry matchup that probably the people in Dublin, Ireland have never heard of, are not aware of. But when this weekend is over, it will probably be their favorite thing about America.
Yes, yes. I would argue this is the most Ireland matchup yet. I know people are going to push back and talk about, okay, well, you have, you know, the Jesuit Boston College, you've got Notre Dame, the Irish, obviously. Look, if you, I don't know, have you guys ever been to Ireland? Have you spent any time in Ireland?
No,
I have not.
Okay, I'm going to pull the pro wrestling card early in the show. I have been around and through Ireland, folks. The ideology of One Manhattan, Kansas and Ames, Iowa permeates on the Emerald Isle. If all these folks spend enough time together, they're going to discover a lot of shared interests here. This is the most Ireland game we've had yet. I'm very excited. I'm also, hey, not that Brett Yormark needs any more PR, because God knows he's aggressively seeking it out at all times. But this is, I like offering up a quality, I mean, you can call it a rivalry, conference matchup to a European site to start the season. I like this. I feel like this is effort expended into week zero. So I'm very excited about it.
I want week zero to be an event. And I like, this is a high quality game between two teams that don't normally get the shine during the season. Like on a regular Saturday, Iowa State's game, Kansas State game, it's not going to be the featured game. So I love that they're getting a chance to be the featured game. And like Rocco Becht, Avery Johnson is a hell of a quarterback matchup. And it's one of those things where coming out of Saturday, depending on who has the better day, we may be like, oh man, this dark horse Heisman guy.
Yeah,
you know, this could be big.
Yeah, these were the two programs that sort of kind of got the short shrift when Arizona State became the darling last year in the Big 12, because both of these probably, I mean, they're what, top five in the Big 12 to slot in. I know there's this sort of like Vegas buffet sized group of teams that could potentially win this conference, but these are interesting and good football teams. So yeah, week zero, we could use more interesting and good football teams, not to slight Idaho State and UNLV, who will be following this up at midday.
What's crazy to me, and I started like, I mean, I knew about this rivalry. I just had no idea that it was the longest continued played rivalry in America. That's pretty wild in college football. It's pretty wild. But it's supposed to end, right, in 2027, because it wasn't one of the protected. And that just kind of stinks. What's going on with that?
Well, they should just protect it. Brett Yormark.
Yeah.
Get to protecting.
What is that going to come at the expense? Like, what are we sacrificing this for? So Iowa State can get an extra game against UCF? Like, no. Like, take your traditions and build upon them. Y'all, if you're not in the Big Two right now, you should take everything that you can that feels like a tradition and blow it out. That's what people want.
Or have them scheduled as a non-conference game. We've seen Wake Forest and North Carolina do that. The Arizona-Kansas State game last year, and I believe the one this year, Arizona and Kansas State, they had previously scheduled it as a non-conference game when Arizona was in the Pac-12, and so they just played it, and it doesn't count toward the conference standing. So, please make sure these two teams keep playing, because this is Americana right here, and the Irish are going to enjoy this. When did they run out of beer? Was it the Nebraska-Northwestern game that they ran out of beer in the stadium?
Yeah, but part of that is, I hate to debunk, but like, no one gets more proud than a college football fan base when a report comes out at a bowl weekend where they're like, and they had to shut down this concession stand. I think that was just more of a staffing issue at, I think it's Aviva Stadium.
I thought the credit card machines stopped working and they couldn't charge them, so they just gave it away. Which, obviously, if it's free, it's going. Quick.
I would, honestly, sell the myth instead of tell the story on this one. Just like, yes, absolutely. You guys, Nebraska. Look, if Nebraska was in Ireland during that phase of their existence, you might as well drink yourself dry. So,
well, Iowa State fans, famously huge Natty Light people. If there's anything that's the opposite of Natty Light,
I forgot about that. What if they imported it over? I don't know how you'd clear customs with a bunch of suitcases and Natty Light. This might actually switch. I just went from saying like, oh, all these customs and people are going to like each other. But I feel like if you introduced Natty Light into a Guinness culture, we might have some sort of international incident. Those people are very, very serious about their beer. And Natty Light is not maybe the first thing I would lead with in terms of American diplomacy right now.
It's alcohol flavored water.
There's talk of the LSU playing a game over there. Can you imagine that one?
Oh, my God. No. As far as I know, Seattle Police Department still has an incarceration record from the LSU Washington 1-1. That is not an urban legend. That is a real thing.
So the LSU fans and the Irish, that's a pretty aggressive form of Catholicism going on right there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're drinking away all the feelings, the good feelings, the bad feelings. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That's peak Catholicism. Try it. Yeah. As long as you're guilty, you can keep drinking.
One thing I think that not just the Irish, but us watching at home will come to appreciate, because, again, it's the only game in town this week where it's kind of got its own window. There are other games afterward, but this is the one power conference on power conference matchup. I think the greater college football fandom will get a good appreciation for what the Big 12 is, which is the most fun conference week to week in college football. This is a 3-point spread. I believe K-State's favored by 3. But I would venture that most Big 12 conference games, I'd say probably 70% of them, will have a spread lower than 5.
Yes. And that's because that logjam I referred to earlier, I think I could posit you could take 8 or maybe 9 teams. I'll rattle them off really fast. Baylor, Utah, Iowa State, Arizona State, K-State, Texas Tech, especially this year, right? TCU, mm-hmm. BYU, and then maybe I'll throw in Kansas before mm-hmm. we even get
Please
to
do throw in Kansas.
Before we even get to whatever is or won't be about Colorado. And any combination of those teams, if you are a passive viewer or one we're wagering on an outcome, if you will, as folks are wont to do these days, that is an entertaining 3 hours of football. And I don't know if you can go 9 deep like that in other conferences. There are better conferences, but I don't know if you can go that deep in terms of entertainment value.
Right. The Big 12's biggest problem, and Ross, maybe you can speak to this, because I remember talking to Brett Bjormark about this a few weeks ago. He points out that they probably do need a couple of big dogs at the top that can kind of tower over everybody and compete for the national title. What I think is most fun about the league is it does feel like the 14th best team can beat the best team on the right day, which is not the case in the SEC or the Big Ten. But I think he's right from a business standpoint that to have a conference that is viable commercially and considered quote unquote successful, you kind of need a couple, 2-3 at the top.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's positives and negatives about that league not having sort of 3, 4, 5 blue blood powerhouses, right? And then this 4 or 5 bottom schools that get beat up on all the time, like you do pretty much in all the other leagues, right? And pretty much the other 3 power conference leagues have sort of a split like that, right? And the Big 12 doesn't. So that it's positive in the way that you don't have that, and all the games seem pretty tight, and it's sort of like the NFL like parity. You never know really who can win at some point. But it's also a little bit of a negative because you don't have that. You don't have those big sort of big dogs and those powerhouses. So I could see both sides. And they're kind of playing into, as they should, right? Sort of leaning into, hey, we're this parody fun league, and you never know what can sort of happen on any given Saturday. And I get that. And I think that's part of sort of the aura when Oklahoma and Texas sort of left. They have to pivot to something, right? And you see what happens with the bottom of that league has kind of like, you know, all, you know, what do they call it? High tides rise all boats.
A rising tide lifts all boats.
Rising lifts all boats. There you go. So, like, but you see Kansas, right? It was down for so long. They've started to rise up, and some others too that were sort of at the bottom of that league. Now, the new schools, like the new sort of G6 schools like Cincinnati and Houston and BYU. I mean, we obviously saw BYU has had success. Like Cincinnati and Houston had to start, you know, making a little more progress, right? Because they don't want to be sort of stuck down there where they have this sort of bottom. They need the whole thing to have some parity.
So who in this league is upset the most right now? And what I mean by that is who is the most entitled in terms of a booster core or a fan base? Because when Red River left the Big 12, I would assume that TCU, Oklahoma State, Baylor said, hey, well, we got next. We should be the ruling class of this group. And that has not panned out yet. I like a lot of what TCU's doing.
I don't think anybody has, because the thing you got to remember is K-State's been good for a long time.
Right.
You know, Bill Snyder, before and after the Ron Prince era, had them near the top of the Big 12, capable of beating anybody in the Big 12. So they feel like they should be that team. You know, Iowa State, since Matt Campbell has been there, has been good. They feel like they should be that team. I think if we looked at who has the pocketbook to make it work, Baylor, TCU, Texas Tech would be your three favorites. But Houston sits in the best recruiting area in the country per square mile, probably. So, like, there's a lot of candidates. It's who goes and grabs the ring.
Yeah, I mean, you can spend the money, but that doesn't guarantee a win, or we'd be talking about the 12-time national champion Texas A&M Aggies. The wonderful thing about this sport is that, you know, you can throw a lot of good money after, maybe not bad, but certainly mediocre. And that's why it was so kind of delightful to see Arizona State and what was beat Iowa State in the conference championship game last year, while those Texas schools who felt entitled and were spending that way couldn't yield those results. Now, all of this is framed around the fact that Texas Tech owned the offseason, and there will be sort of a separate, almost like an asterisk referendum on their progress this year, which is why we talked hot seat last week. It's not that McGuire's on a hot seat per se. It's just that we're measuring ROI in a very different way now.
Yeah. So what's the, I hate to get into too much like in-depth football talk of this Farmageddon, but like, what's the key matchups here? When you look at, I mean, obviously both returning starting quarterbacks, right? They're really exciting players to watch. So, excited about that, but what are we looking at here?
It's quarterback play, you know, definitely.
Who does Rocco Beck throw to?
Yeah.
Because he had two incredible receivers who are now in the NFL, and that was, you know, they were a dynamic offense last year because of that. So it's how does their passing game evolve? And then I think for K-State, like Avery Johnson, when you saw him his freshman year, when he was splitting time with Will Howard, you looked at this guy and you thought, okay, he is 6'4". He's 220 pounds. He might be as fast as Lamar Jackson. Like, it's wild how fast this dude is. But then he becomes the starter last year, and he didn't play that fast anymore. And I think that's the question is, will he take that leap where his speed, which is superior to probably everybody else on the field, becomes the deciding factor in games, or is there still a little bit of struggle in terms of processing in the passing game? Like, you go back to the BYU game last year, some interceptions is just like blow your mind.
Game, that weeknight game Houston against game. Houston. Yeah. I think if you're looking for pressure here, Matt Wells is sort of being tasked as being the whisperer. He's the guy who's supposed to elevate Avery Johnson, not
K-State
into
OC.
Yeah, not into former Texas Tech head coach, former Utah State head coach. Avery Johnson, like, this is what arguably the biggest name they've landed, an in-state blue chip quarterback prospect. They paid for an NIL. They're expecting like Heisman caliber here. I mean, there's a lot of hope that you wouldn't. This narrative is not something you would normally associate with K-State, because as Andy alluded to earlier, like, the consistency of the Snyder era was always kind of like, we found this JUCO junk pile that we sort of retrofit year by year into an effective offense. Like Colin Klein, right? Now the offensive coordinator at Texas A&M, great example, right? It becomes kind of a K-State legend as sort of like a, well, we can kind of fit him in here and do this, and we're going to switch it up for this kid this year. This is not that story. This is, there was a blue chip in state. We went after him. We kept him home, but now we have to bring him into a Heisman level conversation. They have not done that yet. I think Wells is under a tremendous amount of pressure to that regard.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this, because Avery Johnson's one of those, when you saw him as a freshman, you thought this is going to be a special, special QB. And sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Yeah. But a lot of times we look at a person in their first year as a starter and say, okay, whatever, they're kind of meh. And then they blow us away. Joe Burrow is a good example of this. Like, if you look at Joe Burrow's 2018 season, it's fine. But nothing about that told you what was going to happen the following year.
This is why I don't want to talk about Texas right now, but I keep sort of kind of gently getting people ready for Arch Manning, snap in, snap out. It's a different thing than being like essentially a sort of gadget weapon, which is how he was used. So Johnson has to get better. Flat out, they have to get this kid to arrive on a national level. So what better way than doing it conference rivalry game, and everybody in the country who cares about college football will be watching.
In against the best pass defense in the country last year, I think, right?
Well, so Iowa State is interesting because their defense was not as good last year as it has been in previous years. But John Haycock, their defensive coordinator, created the defense that a lot of people use now to defend modern offenses. It's a 3-3-5.
3-3. Yeah, the 3-3.
Yeah. And so it you know, Joe Lee Dunn was the guy from long ago, Mississippi State created the 3-3-5, but Haycock is the one who modified it to deal with these offenses. And every defensive coordinator in the country has stolen something from John Haycock over the last 5 years. So this is the, you know, his defense is designed to stop this kind of offense. So we'll see what happens. But Ross, I'm curious because you wrote in your On Three column this week about the future of Week Zero. And I've always wanted more out of this week. Now, I don't know if I wanted the entirety of Week One shifted to Week Zero, but I'd probably take that just because I like more football. But what is the future as the people who run the sport discuss the calendar?
Yeah. You know, this has been something discussed for quite some time, right? I think I can go back all the way to maybe three or four years ago. The College Football Playoff had a like subcommittee who started studying how to just move up the entire season. And obviously the easiest way to do that is to turn Week Zero into the new Week One. Everybody just start on the week before Labor Day. And you shift everything. So rivalry games would come off of Thanksgiving. And conference championship games would be on Thanksgiving instead. And so everything would shift up. And that way, you would have the first round of a 12-team playoff, or maybe even a 16. You would have the first round play on the second week of December when it doesn't impose on the sort of the NFL, when the NFL starts playing, right? And then you have the championship game would end up being, instead of like mid to late January, would be back into like early January. So it doesn't get too far into January. So I think the goal is to do that eventually. And the problem is all these groups that kept looking at this, which was 3 or 4 years ago, and maybe even a couple years ago, they looked at it again. There's always like a roadblock that pops up. Often, you guys won't be surprised, often involving TV networks. So the first thing is the TV networks probably aren't big fans on their rivalry Thanksgiving week being disrupted, you know, having 60, 70 games, a lot of rivalry games that weekend, and instead having 10 conference championship games. All right. That's a big like TV weekend. And I think they like having rivalry weekend there. The other issue with this, and there's a couple of them, is you move the season, like the first week of the season off of the popular holiday,
Labor Day weekend. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You move it off of that. And then another issue is the semifinals go back to being on January 1st, New Year's Day, when, you know, you would then have the quarterfinals, all these big bowl games not being on New Year's Day. You'd have them the week before.
Well, you know, they don't really need to play the quarterfinals in bowls. They could play them on campus where God wants the games to be.
You're right on
that. Yes, but what would the Rose Bowl say?
What would the Rose Bowl say?
The Rose Bowl can host a tractor pull. If they don't like it.
Oh, man.
Sunday. Yeah, Bigfoot and Gravedigger can tear up the field at the Rose Bowl for all I care.
The reason why I like this dynamic of the show is that I might actually not be the most anti-Rose Bowl influence here. Like, Andy may be one of the few people in the entire working media who dislikes the Rose Bowl.
The Rose Bowl's amazing. More than I do. The environment's great. It's beautiful. The grass is beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. It does not. It's not so beautiful that it needs to dictate what happens everywhere else in sport. That's the part that bothers me about it. And look, we're all from the South. So like we have a different, well, maybe I don't want to speak for you guys. I have a different view of it. The Big Ten people romanticize the Rose Bowl because it sucks where they live in January and they want to go to Pasadena. Yeah. It's beautiful where I live in January, so I don't really care.
One thing I will give, I will give a little sort of like nod to our friends in other parts of the country than us. Ross, when they commissioned that study, I'm curious if they looked at, let's just say, just the Power Four. How many schools are in session on August 25th or 6th? Because I know a lot of the Northeastern and Midwestern schools don't go back the way that we do in the South.
Or your quarter system schools, which don't start until late September.
Right.
Mid-late September. That's right. Yeah. I mean, like Oregon, I think their first school week is the third or fourth week of the season, you know? So, yeah, that would be really early. Yeah, that'd be really early. Another problem with this, all this is, like, you have all these deals with the conference championship games, the location for that week. And you have to get out of potentially get out of those contracts. And there's just there's a lot of hurdles, and it's just not going to happen like next year or even probably the next year. But I think most believe in the sport. They've got to find a way to make this happen just to get the championship game earlier, like just to get the championship
out of late. It felt too late last year.
Yeah,
it really did. And it's I think it's around the same time this year. I think it's the 19th.
Yeah.
This year it was the 20th last year. I think in a few years it's like the 21st or 22nd. Like, I think everybody agrees that's just too late.
Well, and this also might create a solution for what I felt like. I wasn't on site for either one of the final four games, but it just didn't feel big slotted on a random Thursday in January. It just didn't have that magnitude. I know why. We don't have to do the NFL conversation today, but maybe there's a way to better place this if we create more space in the calendar. I have much more naive hope for week zero. I'm sure it's not going to happen. I would rather see more better inventory, to Andy's point. But also, we're seeing a lot more of these FCS teams and schools. You guys were talking about getting exposure, even for Iowa, for Farmageddon, right? It's going to get blocked out on a normal Saturday. It was like 2 years ago. We're doing a live podcast in Minneapolis. I saw North Dakota State and Eastern Washington play in the Viking Stadium. That feels like a fun week zero thing that television could throw a little help behind. It feels like if nothing else, maybe the FCS could help populate this and some of the more fun, interesting game like teams and styles. I know that we'd have to pass a waiver for all that, but just something extra.
But here's what I imagine gets them over whatever issues they have, like with Thanksgiving weekend and that sort of thing. The populace is so starved for real football right now.
Yeah.
And is every year at this time. If you just move week one to week zero, it will do amazing numbers. You'd actually get 2 weeks before the NFL kicks in.
Yep.
So.
Oh, this is a viewership. This is a valley. This weekend is a desert by television programming standpoint.
There's nothing going on in the sports world. Like,
no, ESPN created.
Thing was last weekend.
Well, ESPN created the Little League World Series specifically to fill this gap. That is a manufactured event. You know, the
exploiting 12-year-olds for fun and profit. Like, did you see the Little League of America put out there? Please stop gambling on the Little League World Series.
We need to get to something way...
12-year-olds, for God's sake.
We need to get something way more sensible in there, which is exploiting 18-year-olds with CTE, okay? Like, that's what we do in this country.
They're adults at this point. They have
agency. That's right. They're fine.
They're getting paid,
Godfrey.
They're getting paid now. That's right. I should just shut up about everything.
There you go.
I can retire now.
Mm-hmm. We got to take a break, but when we come back, we go from talking about the way things are now to a school that is hoping that they go back to the way they used to be. Heading to Morgantown to talk Rich Rod when we come back. Welcome back. Ross Dellinger had an excellent story on Yahoo.com on Thursday about Rich Rodriguez's return to West Virginia, the pride of Granttown, West Virginia, who, well, read Ross's story, he wasn't the pride of Granttown, West Virginia for a while, but now he is again.
Yeah.
It's a strange deal because this is a guy who was beloved in his home state. He left, became hated in his home state. Kind of wandered the wilderness of college football for a while. And now he's back.
For a second. Arizona's considered the wilderness. Like, I mean, he had a pack of
Alabama
job,
is considered the wilderness.
Yeah, he actually called himself, I wrote it in there, like Forrest Gump, right? He was in the bayous of Louisiana, right? At UL Monroe in the swamps of Louisiana, in the desert of Arizona. Upper Midwest, the cold Michigan, and then the hills of North Alabama and in North Mississippi. So it was he said he had this nomadic sort of Forrest Gump venture before. All roads, as he said, leads back to the country road. So he's back, and it's weird. It's odd when I went back there, visited, I spent about a day and a half there, and you know, he's got six former players or former coaches on his staff that were either he played for him or either coached for him at West Virginia. He's got, you know, his two children on staff. And he's got his old secretary that was there when he was at West Virginia, still the secretary. It's just all the same equipment guy who was there is there. So there's a lot that just hasn't changed. It's almost like he walked right in to sort of the same situation. But obviously the emotional element, as you mentioned, of all this sort of comes through, right? Like they basically, the state basically like stripped most of everything about Rich Rod when he left for Michigan and how he left and all that stuff. And so like you can't find many mentions even in the football facility of his name, right? And he had the best 3 years in school history, 05, 06, 07. And so there was just a lot of hard feelings. But for the most part, it does feel that most people, you know, have forgiven him. And I think Granttown, his little tiny coal mining town that he's from, which is about 40 minutes southwest of Morgantown, a town of 550 people, by the way. It takes about 3 minutes to drive from one end of the town to the other. And the speed limit's like 30. So it's crazy small. But like they had a sign up in a home of Rich Rodriguez. And then when he left for Michigan, they vandalized the sign and it got destroyed. But they put a new sign back up. And so it's just kind of this emblematic of like, we forgive you, but oh, by the way, you better win. Right? Always.
Reading your story, I was struck with there's a dichotomy between Rich Rodriguez, the West Virginian, which he likes to advertise a lot, and Rich Rodriguez very much not acting like a West Virginian, in that it seems like in some of the quotes he gave you, he was almost still a little shocked at how hard they held that departure against him. And I don't want to get into relitigating why he went to Michigan. Obviously, there was a commitment at West Virginia that was lacking, and it was Michigan, by the way. But this is one of those places in the United States that Rich Rodriguez should know more than anyone else holds downright brutal, self-sabotaging level of identity. And what I mean, is like, hop down to Marshall, where like, you remember like a couple years ago when Charles Huff, it kind of looked like he was on the up and he just did the normal thing that every coach does every year, which is like, hey, I'm at Marshall, maybe I'm going to interview or like have a cup of coffee with an ACC job that might open. When Marshall found out, they were stunned. They were shocked. They thought like, oh God, surely Charles Huff was going to retire here. West Virginia is that place. And so the funny thing about Rich Rodriguez coming back here is that like, as I read your story, it was very interesting to see how he sort of split his time between like, well, I know this place better than anyone else. And also I'm so shocked that they were pissed off at me. Like it kind of feels like he's struggling to pick a lane here. And the word nostalgia, Ross, came up in your story. Mm. I checked only once, as it seemed like leadership was it the school president that invoked it? Was cutting that criticism off.
Yeah.
So did you bring that up, or did he make a point to say this is not a nostalgia play?
No, he try to remember like the actual interview. I mean, I think it was brought up by a lot of people there when I spoke to them about bringing him back. Like there was an emphasis on, we didn't do this just to, you know, repair what was, you know, destroyed years ago and to have this, to create this like great story and all this stuff. We didn't do this. We did this to win football games. And we think he knows the state in the school, in the people enough that he can win football games. And obviously he proved at Jacksonville State that in this era he can win. Obviously it's going to be a different sort of different at West Virginia. And as we got into it in the story, like this is, you know, one of the smallest states in the union, and it's one of the poorest. And so in a world where college athletics is moving more and more into money, right? Can they win there like they did? Can he get West Virginia in this era? Can he get them back to, you know, potentially, you know, one game away from playing for the national championship game? And everybody kind of agrees that it's going to be a lot tougher, right, than it was 15, 17 years ago.
Yes.
I think that a lot of people there that made this decision were sure to point out that we want to win. We didn't just do this. You know, we could have hired somebody else, and they had, you know, we wrote it in there, right? They They had a lot of candidates. Jeff Munkin of Army was, I think, at the end right there with Rich Rye, and they were trying to make the decision. And ultimately, they took the home state boy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if anyone who followed that search would know, there was a lot of pressure and a lot of corners to bring back the native son because things were forgiven, and there were a lot of relationships he did go about repairing. I would say maybe after he kind of left Arizona in a little bit of a mess with some personnel issues, you could tell he's kind of wanted to come home for a while. Did you get that impression? Like he wanted to be back, and he also knew, given his status, like he was. This is pre-Jacksonville State. I mean, he was an OC on some pretty bad Ole Miss teams post-sanctions from the NCAA. Like, West Virginia felt like if he was going to have the late career resurgence, that was probably the ceiling. That he could get home, he could pull on some heartstrings, and that seems like what he did. It also helps that, like, one of ESPN's most prominent personalities now played for him and was kind of really rattling that saber, you know, behind the scenes and in front of it for a good year and a half.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that sort of stuck, like you did nail it, like he wanted to come back for a while. Like he's wanted to be sort of embraced by the state again. And you kind of pick up that when you talk to him. He was gone for 17 years. He returned maybe once a year. He played in a golf tournament, I think, like at one of the fancy golf.
The Greenbrier.
There. Maybe Greenbrier. Yeah, I think it might have been that one. And so he returned almost once a year, maybe not quite. And you know, his mom is still there, and she's living in Granttown, his hometown. And so he would return to sort of see family once every couple of years. But, like, he didn't ever go back to Morgantown, right? And yeah. he never went back. They never had him back. I think of, like, coaches who – sort of were fired or left and invited back fairly soon after, which it doesn't happen very often. But like Les Miles, you know, I think 2 years, 3 years after he was fired, was invited back to Tiger Stadium to like celebrate maybe their national championship or something. Like, you know, Rich Rod was not invited back, you know, when they celebrated some of this stuff. And you can understand why. And I think that hurt. I think it hurt him. Like a lot of his friends in West Virginia, like I talked to for that story, said that he was hurt. And when I got into it in that story about like why he left and the circumstances around it. And I don't think a lot of West Virginia fans realized how much damage that the West Virginia president did, did to kind of end it the way it did. And how some of the, I mean, Rich Rod claims that some of the donations that were made that were intended for football, right, were sort of misappropriated in other places, which tends to happen at schools. We've seen that quite a bit. And I think it got to the point where he had a meeting with the president a day before he took the Michigan job. And he says, and his friends around him say, he wasn't planning on taking the Michigan job necessarily. He was looking for reasons to stay. And one of the reasons was, give us more resources, give us these donations that were made to football. And the president basically threw up his hands in the meeting and said, we've done all we can.
And interestingly enough, that was a year after he was going to take the Alabama job. So this is after Shula gets fired, before Saban gets hired. The initial target was Rich Rodriguez. It got so far down the road, and he'd basically given them a conditional yes. His wife, Rita, had bought the red dress for the press conference. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't leave. He just decided, no, I had this special team coming back in 2007. Pat White, Steve Slayton, Owen Schmidt, you know, the people who are legends in West Virginia now. And I just can't leave. And part of that helped him decide he couldn't leave is they did promise some more stuff. But Ross, to your point, when they got to a year later, some of that wasn't coming to fruition. And he decided, I got to go. But I want to ask you guys this, because if Rich Rodriguez was 42 instead of 62 and had never been there before, and we said, this is a guy who is the OC at ULM, he goes to Jacksonville State where they've just moved up to FBS from FCS and wins the conference. This is exactly the path that the West Virginia coach would take.
No doubt. Yeah, this isn't that dissimilar to their previous coach, Neil Brown. But I think it's also impossible to separate the baggage. And again, that so West Virginia has really, since Rich Rod left, and I think maybe this compounds some of the elements in Ross's story. West Virginia, the program, changed so much after Rich Rod. Not in terms of scheme or personnel, although those things happened.
Because of conference realignment. No.
So, Andy, I used to go every year to Big 12 Media Days. And every year I would ask Dana some version of the question. Dana Holgorsen, the former head coach, I'd say, what is the actual impact of having basically being out on an island, if you can think of West Virginia as an island? Because I think at the time, I plugged it into Google Maps the other day to bring it up on this show. I think it's 991 miles to the then nearest Big 12 school, which was Kansas. So right. When you think about the wear and tear and just the functionality of a home away schedule in the Big 12, and of course, Dana would say every year, it doesn't affect us. We don't care. And then literally the first time I had like a drink, although I don't have a drink, but first time I had mini drinks with Dana when he went to Houston, he goes, man, that sucked. That absolutely killed us. So it was sort of an open secret. This program was a little bit in the wilderness, but I get the nostalgia play here. Andy talked about basically the best years in program history. They were 60-26 in the Big East. Their biggest win was probably beating Georgia in that Katrina relocated Sugar Bowl after the 06 season.
Yeah, that was in Atlanta. Yeah.
Yeah. They also, if you're from this part of the country, I feel like this bears mentioning, they would beat good Pitt teams. They would beat good Virginia Tech teams. They really cemented their identity in that region and created a lot of reasons to be proud. And
the problem is they didn't beat a mediocre Pitt team.
This is... This 13-9 game, and I'm sure every West Virginia fan in the world is tired of this being brought up every single time the program is mentioned on a national platform. It is honestly the most colossal upset. I when you take in the context, guys, of a program that hasn't been there since, I'm talking about sort of sniffing national title contention and how hard it is to build a winner at that caliber, at that level in the state of West Virginia, it's honestly one of the most devastating outcomes I've ever seen to a football game, ever. And it still defines them. I don't think it necessarily factored into whether or not they're going to bring him back. And Ross, you had something kind of down towards the end of your story about fans thinking he threw the game to go to Michigan. That's total, absolute nonsense. There's no way in hell that would advance any coach's career whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, that's crazy. I know. Yeah, I know. Like, and he was really like, he gets really upset about that, right? Because that was a week or two later, I think. Yeah.
So what I did, guys, I want to bring this up. I went back and looked at a couple similar nostalgia plays because once upon a time in the 2000s, the Big East was kind of what we just said about the Big 12, one of the most interesting and fun to watch football conferences in America. So we have Bobby Petrino, who had a Louisville program that goes from Conference USA to the Big East the first time. But when he comes back, they're in the ACC, right? And then you have Greg Schiano is kind of the other comp, which was they were in the Big East, became a top 10 program. And then when he went back, they go to the Big 10. I'll kind of want to throw out, unless Andy or Ross, you guys object, the Schiano thing's a little bit different because Schiano took a long time before Rutgers became nationally relevant. Like, he built that thing really, really slowly.
He's also the only coach who's ever been good there.
Yeah, yeah.
West Virginia has Don Nealon. Louisville has had other good coaches, Howard Schnellenberger. Like, Greg Schiano is the only person who's ever been good at Rutgers.
I would also argue that right now, if in a redneck sort of way, I called him fair to Midland, I think Rutgers would be okay with that description based on their life in the Big Ten. I don't think they would hate that, and they're okay with him being there for another like 11 years or whatever. But Petrino's kind of the interesting case study here because he came back, but it was sort of he had success after he came back to Louisville. It was really masked by he had Lamar Jackson, and like he never won more than 9 games, even with Lamar. So he has this Heisman, Pro Bowl, whatever you want to call him, best quarterback in the NFL right now. I don't want to get into all that. But that masked a ton of problems that they had on his return, which was that their personnel was not the same caliber and the program didn't run the same way in the ACC that it did in the Big East. And I'm just curious here, if Rich Rod comes back, okay? Like, Neil Brown had 1 9-win season. He was 37-35 overall. And all these instances I'm bringing up, what happens is if you move from mid-major to major and you bring the guy back, roughly, my math is that like you're good for about 1.3 less wins on average per season. What would satisfy West Virginia here? If Rich Rod comes back and they're a 9-win team on average, I don't know if that's...
I think they'd be okay with that now. I think they would.
This is what I'm asking because... it's such a point of pride that Neil Brown was consistent but never exceptional. that I think they want just the energy of Rich Rod back. But so you're saying that if they never really become a Big 12 contender, that that's okay because they have their guy back, kind of similar to Rutgers.
Not because they have their guy back, but I think because now they've been in the Big 12 long enough to understand it's different than the Big East. It's harder than the Big East. They do want them to contend every once in a while. And this Big 12, this version of the Big 12 that we talked about in the Farmageddon segment, they can be competitive.
So in the 13 years they've been in the league, they've won 9 or more games twice. Once under Neil, once under Dana. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And you go back to those halcyon days. And again, this is where nostalgia becomes like an opiate, you know, for the booster core, for the people who want to open up and write checks. Ross, there's a piece, there's a little section in your piece. It sounds like what Rich Rod's doing that will automatically make him better than his predecessor or even maybe Dana before him. Mm. Is that he is lighting a fire under the ass of some of these check writers in Morgantown in a way that maybe only Rich Rodriguez could. I think this is an innate ability of some coaches in certain places to come in and not necessarily win the press conference, but be able to motivate those folks who need to up a donation from $10,000 to $50,000 for whatever it might be, let alone we get into NIL and player comp and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like West Virginia is going to be a richer, more supported program just by default, because Rich Rod is back and he won't tolerate anything less.
Right, right. No, he has. He started, I thought it was really interesting, you know, back when he was there the first go around, he started a booster group to specifically
the name is awesome, dude.
The coaches' recruiting efforts and to put them on a private, so they could take a private jet out of Morgantown, a King Air private jet, and it cost. Then back then it cost $1,100 to rent $1,100 per hour to rent a King Air, and so it was called the 1100 Club, and then he's restarted the 1100 Club. I was like Rich, it costs a lot more now with a King Air to rent for an hour than 1100. It's probably like 5,000 or more, and he said it doesn't matter. We're still calling it the 1100 Club, and they've already. I actually didn't put it in the story. They've already raised. I don't know how much total they raised, but they've raised $20,000 to. So there was this old. This is actually a cool story, and I had to remove it from the story because it just had gotten too long. But there was the law school hill, they called it, right behind the football facility.
Oh, I've run up that hill before.
They've run up. Yeah, they used to like the penalty hill. Like if you jumped off sides, you'd have to run up the hill. Well, now there's student housing or university housing there, so you can't run the hill anymore. So Rich Rod, of course. He's taken another hill and they're like excavating another hill and removing the rocks and stuff. And to do that, it costs $20,000. The 1100 Club has already funded that. So he's going to have a new hill so that players can run. Because, man, if there's anything that Rich Rod is not, he's not soft. And he's not going to have players not run a hill. So he's made sure to create a hill.
So to that end, Ross,
playing in West Virginia is kind of running uphill. So
yes. Yeah. So this is what I wanted to get at, Andy. I checked fitting on metaphor. Three. On three, y'all have West Virginia as number two in the country with 52 transfers behind Purdue. That's a lot of new bodies. There are several quotes in the piece that seem to be catnip for old heads. Let's just say it nicely, in that like, I don't care about NIL. I don't care what you're making. We're gonna be a hard-ass, like all your typical pablum for you know boomer type motivation. Kids today, how dare they? Yada, all that BS. Is this going to play in the modern game? Is this going to work? I don't doubt the man's scheme. He can be successful at any level. He knows ball, but as a program manager, is this going to work?
Yeah, in Ren Baker, the athletic director, asked that question right in my story when we started talking about Rich's sort of approach to the athlete rev share. So he's holding out a pool of money to sort of give to players once they win a starting job, right? Or once they get into the two deep or once they perform just in general. And so he's not paying them fully, right? Until they sort of prove it is how he's approaching it. And Ren Baker, the athletic director, asked in the piece, you know, is that the way, will that work sort of in the future? Will that strategy work? And he kind of like, we're going to see.
Yeah,
we're gonna see, but we don't really know now, and nobody knows how. Like everybody's sort of approaching rev share differently. There's all kind of different ways that coaches sort of are distributing the money and how they're distributing the money and when they're distributing the money and who they're distributing the money to. And this is certainly one kind of unique way, right, is holding a lot of the money until people perform. And so I think that's an interesting strategy. And again, I don't know if it's going to work or not. We'll see.
The New Orleans Saints were trailblazers.
We shall find out when we return, though. Each one of us will offer his most controversial prediction for the 2025 season. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the College Football Inquirer. It is time to make predictions because real football will be on our TVs on Saturday. We need to make predictions for the 2025 season before the first snap. And everybody's got their, oh, do it by conference, do it by, you know, by team. Okay, no, we're just going the spiciest, the sauciest predictions we can possibly make. I will start, gentlemen. I wrote this week at On Three, and I do believe this. This was not engagement bait. It had nothing to do with the fact that this program was in the news, though that certainly helped create more engagement. I believe that Auburn will win at least 9 games this season. And I realize they are the butt of everyone's joke this week because their athletic director, John Cohen, decided to claim a bunch of new national titles. And the Auburn fans, by the way, I feel so bad for the Auburn fans in this situation because they're like, guys, we've been making fun of Alabama over this for decades. Why are we doing this? And then
I was going to say, Andy, I think it's great. I think it's fantastic, by the way. I just want to throw that out. Like, yeah, you know what Tommy Tuberville needs right now? Credit for a national title. That would be
the Golf Digest national title. Yes. So here's the thing. Auburn has an excellent roster this year. Keldrick Falk, if you don't know who that is, trust me, you will Friday night of next week when they're playing Baylor and he is terrorizing Sawyer Robertson. Keldrick Falk is, if you ask the NFL people, one of the best edge rushers in the country.
Okay.
This is Auburn's best offensive line in 10 years, probably. They went in the transfer portal, got some guys. This guy named Xavier Chaplin is their left tackle. He comes from Virginia Tech. He's another one that's a potential maybe first or second round draft pick. They have a player who started 27 games for them the last 2 years who couldn't win a starting job this year, and he'll be their sixth man. I mean, that's something Auburn hasn't had. They have Cam Coleman, who's an otherworldly wide receiver. They pair him with Eric Singleton Jr., the slot receiver who transferred from Georgia Tech, who you're going to play Where's Waldo with him. But oh, by the way, you still got to deal with Cam Coleman. Like, if Hugh Freeze doesn't screw up the quarterback thing, they're going to be really good.
That is an if that is 4 stories tall. does this include, is it just, I know you had to have played the schedule game in order to make this prediction. Yeah. Does this include winning at Baylor? Just out of curiosity.
Yes, they probably got to win at Baylor. They don't have to beat Georgia or Alabama, but they get both of those at home, so they could beat one of them.
I'm counting. I'm now figuring out what games you have. Okay, are we winning in College Station?
That is the big question.
Okay. Okay. All right. I'm not here to judge.
But if you win at Baylor, questions. You don't have to.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. This is true. Okay. All right. Mine is that no matter what. And I do mean no matter what. The SEC and the Big Ten will each put 4 teams in the college football playoff. And as someone who celebrates the far corners of college football and likes to stump for the little programs and believes in the diaspora of the sport and the fact that Boise's Blue Turf and the FCS are great additions, I am a broken soul now because I am so sick of hearing about the machinations and backroom dealings in order to finagle, manipulate, and change the college football playoff after one 12-team formatted year. Let's just give the kingpins what they want for one season. So, my prediction specifically is that you do see some, one might say, logically undeserving 9-win SEC team, for instance, getting in at the expense of someone else. Rhett Lashley, call me. We can talk about chemtrails. We can talk about how the government tracks you and your money. We can talk about, like, I love the X-Files, dude. Let's go. Like, I'm your Huckleberry. Okay, I'm right here with you. But you're getting screwed this year. You better go undefeated.
So I've got one. It's a little out there, and I'm sure okay. I'm going to get crushed for it. But a conference other than the SEC or Big Ten actually wins the national championship.
I love it.
Maybe a school that's won it plenty over the last few years, located in South Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a great pick. Clemson, of all these teams at the top of the polls, I feel like they have the least question marks. Like, I know what I'm going to get from every position group at Clemson. I don't have to ask, and I think they're all going to be good. Everybody else, there's like one position group where you're like, ooh, boy, if that doesn't work out, this could get ugly.
Did we? I don't know if y'all did this quite maybe to the degree I did. The advent of NIL, portal era, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, kind of felt like Dabo's epitaph had been etched in stone. And that wasn't necessarily because of any personal feelings that any one of us in the media had. Dabo was standing out there beating his chest saying, I'm not going to innovate. I'm not going to adjust to the times. If this Clemson resurgence is a real thing and they end up even in the Final Four, this is one of the most unexpected comebacks in the last 20 years of the sport.
This is the Undertaker gif.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially. With the same begrudging refusal to change his gimmick, I might add. Like, this is... Nobody thought the way Dabo was talking 4 years ago that they would be relevant like this.
Yeah. Yeah. In Klubnik, maybe he captures the big trophy. And, they don't have to beat... that would be great if they beat LSU at home to open the season in order to on the march to this national championship. But you know what? They don't have to anymore. We all remember what happened to Ohio State, right? Last year, losing two games and
quality loss.
They won it all. You can still do it. And I think like the college football fans that are used to like you have to go undefeated, right? You don't have to anymore. They proved that last year, and I think perhaps Clemson will maybe prove that this year, because I do think LSU is going to be pretty salty as well. And that's going to be a great game. That's going to be a fun one.
It's a quality schedule. It's a resume schedule, which is not something you can say about a lot of teams outside of the Big Two. This is built for a resume.
Well, I cannot wait for that. I'm going to be at that game, and I think it's the most exciting game of week one, which is crazy when you think about you've also got Texas, Ohio State, you've got Miami, Notre Dame. But I think in terms of storylines and everything else, it is entirely possible that that's the one we're talking about at the end of week one. So I'm with you, Ross. I think that's a bold but plausible and excellent prediction. I predict that we'll be back on Tuesday talking about actual football, picking games, getting ready for the real week one.
Yeah.
I cannot wait. It's God so exciting. Bless. But in the meantime, remember, Nat, you can now watch College Football Inquirer on the Yahoo Sports Network. So if you look at the homepage on your TV, you may see it there. But you can also go to yahoosports.tv and you can watch all the shows, Yahoo Sports Daily, Yahoo Fantasy Forecast, the Ariel Helwani Show, and of course, the College Football Inquirer. We love you. We'd love if you just watch our beautiful faces on your TV as well. But however you want to consume us, please do. And please tell a friend.
We're everywhere.
Thank you so much.
We're on cell phones.
Yeah.
We're on cell phones. We're on gas pumps. Come say hi.
We will talk to you on Tuesday.